podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
I'm Sam Keir, host of Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. For the past 12 months, I've been talking to T20 star David Visa, getting his take from behind the scenes at the IPL, the 100 and the rest of the world's biggest leagues.
That's the Don't Nearly View system, Diogo. There's no ways in my mind that was up.
These guys don't know how to win at this stage.
He had his driver pick him up in his Bentley.
People start chanting your name. You kind of have to pinch yourself.
Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Sport Social.
Hello and welcome to this week's Friday Tour Live. I'm Neil Atkinson and I'm away, which means we're doing it a little bit differently, as you might expect. Coming up, there's me having a conversation with Martin O'Neill before we've got a special long interview with him next week about his book. Also, Harriet Pryor is speaking to Gemma Bonner. And after Michael Calvin interviewed James Milner, we've got a couple of clips from that and me chatting to Michael about what footballers expect now and the way in which the game is changing through the eyes of people like James Milner. Hope you enjoy Tour Live this week. Let's go.
Neil Atkinson with Martin O'Neill in a London hotel. It's very nice as well. Lovely cup of tea. We're settled in to talk about your book on days like these, Martin. And the first thing I want to sort of ask, which you often do with people who've written books, is did you feel it was the time to tell what an unbelievable long story of a life in football?
I probably did, Neil. My career, both as a player and a manager, has spanned about 50 years. And when I started thinking about it, you know, from first day as a professional footballer in England way back in October of 1971, when I think about it really, which I didn't at the time, probably, less than 6 years after England had won the World Cup in 1966. So, and I suppose it was the changes that have taken place, both some for the better, some not so great, better pitches, all that type of stuff, changes of rules in the game. And I suppose, yes, I thought that I started off by the 2 days that I probably remember best would be very first day as a coming over from Northern Ireland to be a professional footballer in England in October 1971. And then, of course, the day that magician Brian Clough arrived in January of 1975. So I started to write around those two particular days, and I found that, I just kept going. So writing it myself, doing longhand, was I think became a bit of a problem, but it's all I ever remember from my school days. So eventually my daughters told me that there's easier ways of doing this, Dad, but I felt better. I genuinely felt better about it as I'm writing it down. At least I could correct my spelling mistakes, and I could do all sorts of things with it. So that and the process itself is a wee bit longer than normal, but it was the way I liked it.
The way to talk about things, go back to those school days and then leap forward to the arrival of Brian Clough into Nottingham Forest. It strikes me that the book is entirely, I think, about you being in networks that you felt got the best out of you and got the best out of the other, mostly men, around you all the way through. And that's something which is continually sort of comes back up in there, that you responded continually to environments, changes in environments. The manager prior to Brian Clough, you didn't like him at all, you couldn't work with him, didn't function at all. Brian Clough then arrives, it's different. The school move that happens whilst you're growing up in there. It feels to me as though over and over again, you're both fortunate and respond really positively to your environment changing, and that's a massive part of what the book's about.
Well, that's very kind of you to say so. Sometimes during these sort of changes, I wondered whether it was whether I was as positive as you're making it out to be. I was the eternal sulker, I must admit. I'm not even sure that's changed a great deal in my life, but well, first of all, you talk about the changes that are taking place in your life. One, moving from troubled-torn Northern Ireland for a start to wanting to become a professional player. This was the big thing. This is exactly what I wanted to do for quite some considerable time, probably since I was 8 or 9, when Match of the Day first came on, or European Cup finals were covered and FA Cup finals were covered live on TV. And this is it. Just to play, one game in the English League was obviously a big ambition. And when I got the opportunity to go over, then trying to make those adjustments to be coming from being an amateur footballer to being a professional player. Now, just because I signed professional forms did not make me a professional footballer overnight, although I thought it did. I thought, I'm okay. So I scored within 23 days, I think it was, in the Premier League, or the First Division, as it was called, away back in 1971-72. And it was remarkable, really, because... And then a couple of weeks later, I score against George Best, Bobby Charlton, and Dennis Law at Old Trafford, come on as a sub. And I think, this is a really easy game. Unfortunately, reality hit in pretty quickly. But you're talking about the adjustments you're having to make. Yeah, those were the things. New environment, trying to become a professional player, trying to hack it, really, at the end of the day, and seeing the changes that were there. Oh, no, just up front with all of those.
But the changes that you sort of go through yourself, you're very honest about. I'm struck, for instance, with your relationship with Brian Clough and Peter Taylor is enormously complex. Mm. It's ended now in a moment. You know, you talk about, for instance, speaking at a memorial and being so proud around Brian Clough to being asked to do that, but... We get to see the complexities of this. This is not, everything was always wonderful and we always got on brilliantly. Mm-hmm. And then when you're a manager, for instance, the way in which you discuss the fact that at first you really had no trust or faith in Gary Parker, mm-hmm. and then he becomes an incredibly important player, and you realise that you yourself, and so when you're sort of saying there, you know, you view yourself as being sulky, mm-hmm. what I think is really interesting is the number of times you change your mind, that you realise that, hang on, do I need to change here? Mm-hmm. And that's what comes through the book over and over again, that you change, and you're very honest about those changes.
I'm pleased you said that, because that is absolutely right. You know, there are certain things you can be steadfast about, but there are other things that you have to have a look at. You know, you're hoping that you set out in the game, certainly in terms of my managerial time, with some sort of principles, you know, but you've got to be flexible. You know, there has to be a view that you have to, some player might actually come up with a viewpoint, might not happen too often, but might come up with a viewpoint that you think, hey, do you know what? That's actually worth listening to. So, and if it means that it's a complete change of my mind, yeah, fine. So you're talking about the arguments with Gary Parker. Absolutely. Gary and I had a scene in the dressing room where I think he was trying to stick up for one of the players at the time. And I saw this here as a sort of an almost like a barrack room lawyer type. But then, and I leave him out of the team. And then I realise, you know, in the training that he settles down. We both... And then on the day of the probably one of the most important days of my managerial career is winning at Wembley in the playoff final. We get a penalty and we have to score this penalty with 15 minutes to go. And I'm not joking. I would have put Gary Parker in front of Messi to take the penalty.
Yeah.
That's how much confidence I had in him scoring that penalty kick. It was amazing. Of course, you're still in trepidation, but I thought it. So those changes, and do you know what? Subconsciously, I think great managers do these things. They might not own up to it, but they do make changes. I know that the great manager himself, Brian Clough, one of the greatest managers that ever been in the game, would occasionally listen to see what was being said and actually would say, "We'll think about it. I'll probably not change my mind," he said, "but we'll think about it." And then, absolutely, he's gone with what maybe one of the players has said.
With everything in the book, it's called On Days Like These. Do buy it, basically. Read it. It'll be out in paperback at the start of May. It's available now still in hardback. It is very, very good indeed. Within the book, I think there's crucial things that you're able to document. And for me, there is, in a way, that is about emotion. And I'm going to talk more to you about emotion in a longer conversation we have. But it strikes me, the way you frame the back-to-back European Cup wins, in the mind of the average football supporter, they're back-to-back European Cup wins. Mm-hmm. In the mind of Martin O'Neill, they were not back-to-back European Cup wins, because one of them, because you're not involved in the final, because of what happens with your medal, you just did not feel part of that in any sort of meaningful, emotive way. The second one, you play the final, you're on the pitch when the goal's scored. Mm-hmm. This is your European Cup win. how long did it take you to reconcile yourself with the fact that the first one's yours as well? Do you think you've ever properly done that, or because you didn't feature in the final, do you still feel as though it's still not entirely your victory?
It's a very good point, and it's been pointed out to me by John Robertson, my assistant, brilliant footballer at Nottingham Forest, the scourge of Liverpool, let me tell you, way back in those days, and John was the fulcrum of our team. And John he became my assistant manager for Leicester and Celtic and Aston Villa, and so on. We got on brilliantly. And John has to remind me, he said, Martin, you did score a goal in the quarterfinals against Grasshopper Zurich, yeah, that became unbelievably important for us because we were taking a real hammering at the time. And you played, and to me, in terms of everything, the semi-final against Cologne, the two matches against Cologne, which effectively, really, Neil, were probably the final, you know, because we probably were expected to beat Malmo in the final.
Yeah.
So if I think about that, that's fine. But I'm telling you, when you are not part of it, and it'll be interesting to talk to Archie Gemmell as well, none of the two of us got on the field of play in that time. And you don't, and when the final whistle is gone, and you haven't participated in the game, and if players are in really honest about themselves, I don't feel as if that they would, or sorry, I feel as if they would say the same thing, that they don't really feel part of it. And then the problem with it after that is that Nottingham Forest have just won the European Cup. You haven't played in that final. You're not going to get another chance again. It's never going to happen. Remarkably, it did do, and I kind of feel sorry for Archie, because Archie left the football club, and Archie was a brilliant footballer. He left the football club to go to Birmingham City. I stayed on at the club, then we get to the final and we win it the following year. So maybe John Robertson has made me feel a lot better about it, but the fact remains is that at that time, and for a long time, you do not feel part of it.
Do you feel as though, so the last question of this one before we have the longer chats, do you feel as though that would be different now? To some extent, not to a complete extent, if there's a player who expects to play in a final and then doesn't feature at all, because that's the other thing, it wasn't just that you and Archie were on the bench and you came on for 15 minutes, you didn't feature at all.
Yeah.
Do you feel as though, given the nature of the way squads are now, sort of 20-man squads, 9 subs on the bench, 5 can now be used, do you feel as though players now would feel exactly as you did, or do you actually think that your emotional reaction is a bit of an artifact of the time?
That's a really good point. It's a really good point, and I think you would have to maybe ask. I think there maybe is this feeling that managers, we all as managers, want everyone to feel part of it. You know, part of your man management skills are actually keeping the players as happy as they possibly can be, if that's all right, when they haven't played in the game. But you saw scenes there, just Arsenal winning in the very, very last minute against Bournemouth, and the scenes then with the substitutes running onto the field of play. So, I think now you've just mentioned a very good point. You can use five players can get on at any given time. So when that final whistle goes, and let's say you've only been on for 7 or 8 minutes or something, but maybe have contributed something in that time, then that's absolutely fine. It would be really interesting to ask the player now today, someone who has not been part of it and didn't get on even with the 5 subs, but has been one of the substitutes, how he feels about, particularly about a really, really big game, you know, like a final of a competition or something like that.
Excellent stuff. Do check the book out. It is quite the journey through what is effectively 50 years of football history in the company of Martin, all the way through from the moment in which he turns professional to the point at which his time in the game finishes so far. It is called One of These Days. It is the absolute business.
We've got Gemma Bonner with us now ahead of a huge game next week, next Friday, 7:30, Goodison Park, Liverpool Women versus Everton Women. How are you feeling about that, first of all?
Excited. I mean, everyone knows the nature of a game, derby game at Goodison. I think from our point of view as a club, we were disappointed to lose out the one at Anfield. So for us, it's probably we've got something to prove. But definitely as a group, we're excited going into it off the back of a good result against Tottenham.
Take you back a few months, Christmas Eve, it was announced that you were rejoining Liverpool. Can you tell us a little bit about your decision and how you ended up back at the club?
Yeah, I mean, I was obviously delighted to come back and sign. I made sure I took my time in terms of making the decision. I didn't want it to be an emotional one as such. But now I'm back, I'm delighted to be back, and I'm hoping to try and help the team wherever I can, use my experience of playing in a different league, being at different clubs and being successful, and hopefully I can come back and contribute to Liverpool and keep pushing.
What did you miss most about being in the city or even being with the team?
You know, it's just nice coming back to Liverpool, being in around the city, being back at Anfield, going to watch the
games. You're going to all the games, aren't you?
Yeah. No, it's just like, I mean, you know, when you're part of it and part of the club, it feels like a family. And for me to be back, I feel like I settled in straight away. So that was a huge positive from my end. And I feel so supported with the people that have been around. The fans have been incredible. Yeah, I'm delighted to be back, but I know there's a lot more hard work to go.
There was a lot of new faces actually in January, and you came in as a new face and an old face as well. What was that like, kind of balancing being a new person with a new team, but also knowing and having the experience and the leadership that you've had at Liverpool?
Yeah, I mean, it's a completely different setup for me, completely new team. You know, I haven't really played with too many of the players. Obviously, I know a few from previous clubs, but for me, it was a complete new challenge, new training facility. So, you know, I was kind of the new girl on the first day too. I was in a couple of days earlier than the other ones, so I kind of got to know my way around a bit. But look, it's difficult going and joining any team midway through the season. You've got a lot of things to learn, and we had a huge few games that came thick and fast. And for me to, I mean, for all the new players to try and embed in the team as quick as possible, learn the formation, learn the style of play, and get to know the girls. I think the girls have been great in terms of helping people settle in. But it's, you know, it's always difficult. But I think every single player has added to the quality of the team, and we keep on moving in the right direction.
And what's the biggest difference, I guess, about maybe either Liverpool or the WSL since you left and have come back?
Yeah, I think you can see it's a lot more competitive. I think going into the games, you know, you see there's teams fighting so tight at the top and the bottom end of the table, and, you know, there's not so much that separates the teams in between. So it's great to see, you know, obviously we've been trying to push the women's game for so long, and now you've got the best players coming over, and the games, you know, the showcase you get in the fans. And I think, you know, for me to be back, I'm glad I'm back in the league and playing against the top players, and, you know, playing at Goodison next week, it shows how far it's come, and hopefully we can get a good red turnout behind us as well.
Yeah, you mentioned there about how competitive the league is and the teams, it's so close at the bottom of the table and in the middle as well. You had a poor result against Leicester, and I think you were all disappointed with that, but the result against Tottenham must have been a really big confidence boost for you guys. What was that like, getting that result?
Yeah, it was. I think, you know, we were super disappointed with the result at Leicester. I think probably the manner in which we lost the game. We knew that we had a lot of things that we could work on, but on the same time, we did a lot of things right in that game. So we knew that, and going into Tottenham, we knew the pressure. Obviously, Tottenham needed the win just as much as we did. So going into the game, we knew it was important, but we knew that if we started off right playing at home, we could use that to our advantage. And I think it's probably one of the best first halves in terms of since I've been in, and I know the girls said probably all season, in the performance that we put in, and I think that probably set the tone for how the game went. We were obviously disappointed it was against the run of play, the first goal, but it showed the fight within the group, and it almost showed the confidence that we had in that first half, that, you know, we knew we were going to go and get one and two and push on from there. And I think the second half, we probably had to show a bit of resilience in terms of, you know, we were inviting a lot of the pressure on, and that's probably for us as a group to learn how we manage dealing in those pressure games and holding the lead. So it was a huge result for us, huge confidence from the game, and obviously we've got to back it up now going into next Friday.
And sitting eighth now, so you must feel like the pressure's off a little bit and you can go and enjoy it maybe next Friday.
I mean, I wouldn't say the pressure off. Look, I want to win in every single game that I play. And we know, you know, there's so much pride riding on next Friday, and that's before even the football comes in. You know that when you represent Liverpool, you've got to go and achieve, and you're expected to win. So we have to make sure we're ready. We've got a few bodies back in training today, which has been a huge positive for everyone in the group and a huge lift. And I think it's important. It showed the strength of the squad, especially the past few weeks. There's players that have come in and done fantastically well, and we've got to keep that energy and make sure on Friday we go and put a performance in that we're proud of, and I'm sure we'll get the result.
Yeah, we all love Fuka as well. We all love watching her play. Just a couple of last things about next Friday. I want to take you back to when you did win the league, when you were captain of Liverpool. You did the double over Everton that year. Mm-hmm. What's it like playing in those derbies and getting the results when they really matter especially?
Yeah, I mean, it's nice now because I feel like the girls understand. Obviously, before there was a lot of foreign players. And I think everyone knows, everyone's played in a derby here now. And you know you've got to expect the tackles, and you can't just expect to turn up and win the game. You've got to put the hard work, the fight in first, and you've got to make sure that you're the one that wins that tackle and almost swings the momentum in your favour. Because I think in any game, never mind in a derby game, it's always hard to get the momentum back once it's lost. So for us, we've got to work on probably the game management and how we approach it. But I think everyone's, you know, excited, and we've got to use the emotion in the right way.
You're a fan as well, so it must make it that little bit sweeter to try and give you that extra bit of motivation.
No, I mean, standing here talking, I'm like, come on, let's go play now. But no, it's, you know, what, you know, you're a Liverpool fan playing at Goodison against Everton. You know, it's what we probably never thought would happen as a young girl growing up. But for now, the games are being played in the big stadiums, we're getting the fans, and you know, we've got to go and make the most of it.
Yeah, you mentioned the fans there. I want to touch on them as well. That we were speaking to the manager, you say maybe 20,000-30,000 people might be there. How much of a motivation does that give you to perform and turn them up for the travelling fans? Well, they've not got to go too far, have they?
No, I mean, for us, we have to represent the fans every single game we go out, and like I said before, when you pull on the shirt, there's an expectation, and as long as you give it all, I think, which is an expectation when you're representing Liverpool, you wear your heart on your sleeve and you go out and do your best. And you know, our fans have been incredible. I think, you know, turning up, it's probably been a rough few years for them. You know, we've had so many highs and so many lows, unfortunately. But you know, there's one thing that's been consistent, and that's the fans throughout this whole time. So for us, we want to give them something to go and shout about. And it's a huge one on Friday. We know it's either red or blue, and we'll make sure it's red.
Yeah, and finally, you've had so many positive memories here and winning the WSL with Liverpool. Are you looking forward to making new memories and for the future as well?
Yeah, look, I know it's very different from when I was here before. I'm very realistic in terms of my expectations and the challenges and the hard work that I've got to put in. But for me, it's an exciting challenge. The club's in a different position now. But like I said before, hopefully I can use my experience from being at previous clubs, different leagues, to help push and keep driving the standards to where we were.
Well, good luck. We can't wait to be there. And if you haven't got your ticket yet, you can go. And there's a nice away end as well, so you don't even have to sit amongst the Everton fans. You can be amongst all the reds, so we'll enjoy that. Good luck for next Friday.
Thank you very much.
Joined by Mike Calvin to discuss his interview with James Milner, which was an excellent listen. I'll give you all the information at the end. We'll do the chat first. And Mike, I want to talk about two clips, so we'll have the first one. It'll drop in, and then we'll have a chat about it. So here is James Milner being asked by Mike Calvin about the attraction and the enjoyment of coaching.
Are you still doing your A-license?
Yeah, just about. Got a couple left, and then I'm done out for the...
Right. So what are the factors which will decide any move into coaching for you? Because let's be honest, that's what a lot of people expect you to do.
Yeah, I think you never know what happens in football. I think, obviously, everyone always says you should play as long as you can. So I still feel good at this moment in time. So depends on options, and things change very quickly in football. So it's hard to have a definite plan. You never know what opportunities are in front of you. And I think you just got to take them as they arise if you're lucky enough to have certain opportunities. You know, some days it's great. You look at managers and coaches and it's great, and things are all rosy and you have a few wins and you see managers getting brand new contracts for doing well, and then 6 weeks later, 8 weeks later, they're under pressure and they get sacked. And it's like, that's the brutal side of football, I suppose. And I think any manager, you know, probably needs a couple of years to get the players in, get the club how they want it and things like that. But nobody seems to get that. And that's the tough part of the business. So you look at other days and think, Do I want to be involved in that? So, you know, I think it would be a shame to move away from football with how lucky I've been with the people I've worked with and the knowledge I've learnt from playing with so many good players and working with managers. It'd be a shame not to help the younger guys, and with me doing my badges and stuff and going and do sessions with the academy now, it's great to be able to speak to them. And it's obviously very different to the first team environment, which is an environment I've been involved in for such a long time. There's little things that you would expect, or not would expect, you take for granted that people know, because I've been in a first team environment for so long. But the academy players, the smallest things can make such a big difference. And you know, they're obviously like sponges, so it's been great to work with the younger guys as well.
Great stuff. And it's, I mean, it's interesting. A couple of things he says around the coaching aspect, Mike. One of the things is obviously doing his license, his A license, as you talked to him about, but him not feeling as though he gets to live the fruition of it, because at the minute he's obviously got to go and train with Liverpool, play games of football with Liverpool as well. I just thought it was really interesting, that idea that, you know, even at that level and even achieved everything that James Milner's achieved in the game, he'd still like the lived experience of, I've put this lad in a position, I've given him the information, I've given him what he needs to know, and then he scores a goal, and he's almost frustrated he doesn't get to sort of have the full enjoyment of that himself, which is, I'd argue, probably one of the core attractions of coaching.
Yeah, I think nothing can beat getting out there on the grass, you know, whether you're a player and or a coach. And when you look at what's going on with James at the moment, he is obviously at a crossroads. And in a way, when you analyze where he's been, this whole sort of emotional process that he's been through, he's seen so many dreams shattered or fulfilled over those 21 years. And to see new dreams being formed in front of his eyes, that's got to be the buzz of it. You know, you talk to coaches and it's this, you impart the knowledge and then you see the application of that knowledge. That's the buzz. That's why they do it. That's why they're out there in the raining and the wind and everything else. It's that moment of recognition. Yeah, I've helped that kid. And also, I just think with James, one of the key areas is like a transference of experience, but also values. And I think that came across very, very strongly in our chat, the culture of the Liverpool dressing room. He obviously experiences that at first team level, but that is transferable down to the academy. And, you know, there are certain ways that a Liverpool or a putative Liverpool player has to behave, or else he's sorted out by the senior players. And I think that to me is where a club can grow organically. You know, we're in the international break and there's loads of transfer speculation et al. But actually, the real work of a football club is done in the shadows. It's done in the academy sessions where you can produce your own players.
Within that sort of conversation you're having with him, it's striking to me where James sort of takes the received wisdom, challenges a little bit. You know, you ask him an old school question and he's very into the idea of, a lot of those values are the core values, but the world changes and people changes. People change, and you've got to embrace new methods whilst remembering the old values. And that, to me, has always been the idea of the old school, the dressing room, the culture flip, is that it's actually a values-based conversation, much more than it's a practice-based conversation. You adapt the practice as methods and time and potential for methodology changes. You know, a really good example of that is that I think when Klopp was at Dortmund, they built a room with a number of lights on and you'd have to kick a ball at one of these lights. It was just Shankly's sweatbox, but without numbers and squares and wood. But it's the same, you know, it just struck me as, we've taken the technology, but the principle and the value and what we're aiming at from the exercise remains the same. And on a bigger sense, I think that's where the smart coaches are, and we'll find out possibly in the fullness of time whether or not James Milner will be one. But it feels like when you are talking about the smart coaches now, they understand where the values have got to remain the same, but they understand where the methodology's got to advance.
Absolutely. And you know, there is what I've always found fascinating is this, the brotherhood of coaching, in as much as that there are, it is a calling in many ways, and they talk very honestly to one another, you know, with a degree of candor that maybe they were, well, James made the point of the sort of contrast between the public facing player coach and the private coach or player. In other words, you know, as he used the phrase, didn't he? It's us against the world, which is obviously a reference to what's been going on quite recently. So I find that fascinating. And also, like, you know, we do lots of interviews, don't we, Neil? When you go to someone like a Klopp or Pep Guardiola or Arteta, but the most honest question you can ask them is, how do you do your job? Why do you do it? And they never get asked that. they get asked whether they're going to sign Jude Bellingham or whatever. This is that's the beauty of it. The simplicity of coaching is getting that kid out there and again relishing their thirst for knowledge and their unfulfilled ambitions. You know, James made the point, you know, these kids out there are sponges. You know, how fulfilling is that to actually almost, you know, you've got a blank canvas there that you can paint on. I that's what I love about coaching.
But isn't one of the hard parts of this the, you know, and one of the bits of this that we sort of don't acknowledge really, or at times we will, you know, at the minute, for instance, there's lots of conversation around the performance of individual Liverpool players. That there's at times a conflict between individual development versus collective development and collective achievement, and that the higher up you are in the overall responsibility, almost the clearer that that comes for you. You know, it's ultimately not Jurgen Klopp, Pep Guardiola's, Mikel Arteta's job to make, for instance, Joe Gomez or Nathan Ake or you know, or Ben White all play their 10 out of 10 game every week. It's their job to have the collective achieve and have the collective develop. And I think that that's something which, when you are sort of dealing with a very young, someone who's very young in the coaching journey, someone like James Milner, that's often a circle they're going to have to go on and square a little bit, from the idea of we asked him to do this and he went and did it and you get to see the result, to where the collective is. And we'll take another clip in a minute, but, and then having to go on and answer for the collective, which I think is at the minute, if you're Milner, looks daunting, looks like, my God, it looks like a lot of work. It looks like really involved stuff. And that's where that job does get more and more complex for them, doesn't it?
It does. And, you know, there are so many, you know, social elements. When you think about it, you know, we live in a world of boomers and zoomers and Generation Y and Generation Z. And, you know, players obviously reflect the generation that they come through. And so, you know, you're talking about a generation now who actually, because they're driven by social media, they think, well, actually, you know, I've got 10,000, I've got 300,000 followers who tell me I'm wonderful. Why do I need to take instruction?
Or who tell me I'm terrible. And that's so don't hang me out to dry. Don't make me look like an idiot, because I'm being told off the back of that goal, following your instruction, but they've gone and scored that goal. I'm an idiot. I'm terrible. 3 million people are telling me I'm terrible. Jamie Carragher's telling me I'm terrible. Gary Neville's telling me I'm terrible. Yeah. And I've done what you've told me. And now this is happening to me. And I think that must be really difficult for managers now.
It is. And you know, there is the individualism now is one of the great challenges of management and coaching, because every player has the entourage, which is the, you know, the modern, you know, the modern phenomenon where, you know, it's parents, it's agents, of course, and they will swoop down on social media like avenging angels on behalf of their player. So you've got all that noise, and that's where, you know, the best managers have no alternative but just to shut all that stuff out, shut all the noise away, all the nonsense, and just do their job. And, you know, that sounds quite simplistic. It's very, very difficult to achieve.
Very difficult to achieve. They, the manager themselves, have the nonsense. Here's James talking about what he sees the leading managers have to do in the context of maintaining their love for the game.
Well, both Jurgen and Pep Guardiola insisted when I spoke to them that a love for the game had to underpin any management career. With what's going on in the game today, you know, the criticism's increasing, the strain is almost institutionalised. Is it too easy to lose that love?
I think it could be challenging at times. I think, I mean, you see the amount of media that they have to do now, and like they're doing press conferences before every single game, after every game, they'll do TV, newspapers, radio. And that's, if you're playing three games a week, that's a lot of talking and a lot of people who are trying to get one slip out of you in that time. So, you know, that's the journalist's job. They're trying to get that line that, and you might say something, but when you've been bombarding and you're saying the same thing over and over, and then, obviously, you have a different story which you want to put out in public compared to the one that you have in amongst the group sometimes. You know, sometimes it has to be, you know, it's us against the world, and you're going to get criticism when things aren't going well at big clubs, and when you're getting praise and things are going well, it's important not to get too up. So it would be very easy to lose that love out, I think, as well. But if you don't have that, I think that's very difficult as well. And the love of the game probably helps you make the decisions you truly believe in terms of, it might not always be a popular decision, but you love the game and you really think it's the right thing. You might see that and eight people disagree with you, but you're the one steering the ship, and, you know, the best managers 9 times out of 10 are right, and they'll always get questioned for it. But I think that love of the game and that belief in yourself, I think obviously, yeah, that's really important.
Yeah.
Excellent stuff. Again, it strikes me, again, I want to contextualise this in Liverpool's sort of current struggles. In my mind, I think you've got Liverpool senior players. It was interesting after the Real Madrid game, both Alisson, Becker and Virgil van Dijk spoke quite stingingly when they were grabbed by media people. They're two of Liverpool's senior professionals. James Milne's obviously one of Liverpool's senior professionals. Jordan Henderson's Liverpool's captain. In there, one of the things that sort of hit me was that there must be something for them where they've been in this with this manager, and then they are seeing him. And I think, you know, we can also contextualise this in the idea of Antonio Conte this weekend as well, Michael, as we're recording. But they are seeing, you know, ultimately, they have to go and do these media rounds. And it's not just one piece of media, as James points out. It's a pre-match press conference, and then it's an unbelievable amount of post-match media that I think most of us don't really appreciate, that it is effectively, it's 5 minutes in the changing rooms and then an hour in front of cameras and microphones for the managers these days. And it struck me as interesting that you know, when those senior players choose to speak separately, choose to speak in the immediate aftermath, they choose, the managers are obliged. But I also wonder at times is that if they're almost sort of semi-looking to now protect their managers, if they're the right type of senior player, because in the back of their mind, they're thinking to themselves, this fella's got to go and do all this. I don't want to watch him have to go and do all this. He's got to go and run through all these hoops. And it's interesting that that's the first thing when you say to James Milner, how do you keep your love of the game? The first thing he thinks of is, well, the big negative is having to go and do an hour's media immediately afterwards.
Absolutely. And you know, that's part of, you know, going back to what we said earlier on, is the us against the world thing, isn't it? He does see his manager do that. And, you know, dressing rooms are very small worlds. And they see, you know, they talk amongst one another. Players talk to other players at other clubs. You know, there's a sort of almost like a Masonic lodge of footballers, really, which is a horrible thing to think about. But there we go. I just think, yeah, the media thing is, you know, blowing my own trumpet a little bit, and I hope you forgive me for this, but what I always try and do is I'm cognizant of these, that they're people, right? So when I don't interview them, I try and have conversations with them, which is what they don't get in the modern media workplace, where it's adversarial and it's trite and you can all predict the questions. You know, the managers that I talk to for doing the podcast, when I'm doing the podcast, they all say the same thing. I loathe press conferences. You know, Jürgen said the same thing to me when we talked, because they know what's coming. They treat it almost with sort of veiled contempt, because, you know, I had a manager once say to me, I never, ever tell the truth in a press conference. Because if I actually said what I really feel, I'd have 3 weeks' worth of this, and it'll go one way, and then it'll go another way, and I won't be able to get away with it for 3 weeks. So I'm not going to do that. I'm going to save myself the aggravation and just come up with a, you know, a word salad, which means nothing. So, you know, and I think sometimes we in the media need to actually look at ourselves there. What are we trying to achieve when, you know, you have the question of the day, however that is, you know, is Tyson Fury going to win on Sky Box Office this week or whatever it is? It's nonsense. So, you know, I'm probably on James Milner's side.
But when you talk about the love for the game, one of the things that occurred to me, and it's interesting, he talks about, for instance, managers maybe needing a couple of years through the interview. Yeah. And I sort of wonder about coaches needing a couple of years. He talks about playing as long as he can. It was sort of reminded me of you know, there's an old sort of Thomas Hardy quote, the secret to quiet happiness lies in limiting ideas and aspirations. And I did, you know, at the minute, for instance, you know, Liverpool legend Steven Gerrard is without a job. And there's a big part of me that if I ever met Steven, and I've only ever met him once, but there's part of me that if I ever met and got to have a conversation with Steven, I'd be like, what do you want a job for, mate? You definitely find stuff that can make you really happy. What do you want to put yourself through all of this for? And I wondered when I was listening to James, because he feels like, I think in a lot of people's heads, he feels like he's one who'll go into management. And I just sort of wonder whether or not he's one who may ultimately feel as though, certainly for a few years, he can achieve a fair amount of happiness just in coaching. That it doesn't have to be out of football, but the idea of the other bits and pieces, he may feel like that. And I wonder whether or not a few more players might start. And you would say yourself, you know, a lot of managers now are quite happy stopping at under 23s or under 21s level because they feel, what do I want to go and do the rest of this for? And I do wonder whether or not there might be a few. Milner might be one example. He might do the complete opposite of what I'm saying. But more and more, if a number of former players who are actually quite high profile might just feel more than happy working with a group of 12 to 18 year olds, developing them to the best of their ability, and then letting someone else worry about the next bit.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned Steven Gerrard there. When I was doing a film for BT, we went to interview him when he was working with the 18s at the academy. And, you know, he was in there. We got there very early, about 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning. And he was there. He'd already been in. He was planning sessions. He was consumed by the process. And he had he exuded this sort of level of satisfaction that I never saw when he was working at first team level. There was almost a purity about what he was doing. Now, obviously, he was learning his trade in that sense now. And I can see the attractions of working in that, that youth space or whatever you want to call it. And it is interesting when you look at, say, the Olympic movement. And, you know, I can go back to old East Germany as an example. Now, okay, history tells us that most of their athletes rattled. You know, they were drugged up to the eyeballs. However, one of the principles, I remember going to Leipzig, and it was one of their original Olympic sort of training centers, where basically you went in there and they told you what you were going to do. So in other words, you might be the second greatest backstroke swimmer in the world, but because of your levers, we're going to make you a gold medal winning rower. There was a great deal of common sense in that process. Okay, I'm not excusing the morality or anything else, but one of the key touchstones was that they allocated their best coaches to the youngest groups. They worked on the principle that anyone can coach a world-class athlete, world-class footballer. Anyone can. But to actually create that world-class footballer, you need a world-class coach at a very, very low level. So that, now, I don't think football gets that yet, because when an academy coach goes in, he gets the under-9s and he wants to become the under-12s coach. And when he's under-12s coach, he wants to be the under-14 up to the 18, and then he's going to pimp himself around for a first team job somewhere. So, you know, there's so much, you know, football is an impure business, but actually if you work with kids, there is a purity to it. And that's why, as I said, you know, it was interesting you talked about Stephen, because he was never, especially when he was at Villa, there was an edge to him. And you looked at him and you thought, you're not enjoying this, mate. You know, why are you doing it? So yeah, who knows? But to sort of summarise with James, I think he'll stay at the club, and I think it wouldn't surprise me if he was brought onto Jürgen's staff, if I'm honest, because as he says, he understands the first team environment.
Okay, excellent stuff from Michael. It's Michael Calvin's Football People. It's on BT Sport. This one had James Milner in, but, you know, he had Unai Emery recently. You know, David Moyes in there as well, Aaron Ramsdale, along with Pep Guardiola, Graham Potter and Jurgen Klopp, all since the turn of the year. Absolutely flying, Michael. Excellent stuff. I don't know who's booking them for you, but fair play.
Well, they put up with me. They put up with me.
Excellent across the board. You want to check it out? It's through BT Sport, as then other journalists he mentioned there, Miguel Delaney, who he chats away with as well. I think it is the best of the weekly podcasts that take a broader view across the whole of the game. Do check it out. It's very much worth listening to. It's Michael Calvin's Football People. It's always a pleasure to speak to him. Sports Social Podcast Network.